Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, we'll get Alex Hollings on now. So joining me, and I don't even know when the last time we talked, is the aforementioned Alex Hollings. Alex, happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, happy Thanksgiving, man. Happy to be back.
Yeah, where you been? What have you been doing?
Well, this last Monday was my daughter's third birthday.
And, happy birthday to your daughter. I see her all the time.
And growing up fast, right? I mean, I remember the day you called me to help walk me through trying to walk my wife through childbirth.
And volunteered, man. I'm like, I'm a pro, man. I have to tell you, I've got four reps. First time I just watched, but the other three I watched at a closer, that's from a better viewpoint. So I consider myself an expert.
Yeah, I got to get right into the trenches. My daughter was born on Thanksgiving Day, as I know you know, but anyone out there listening who may not
be. How about that?
Yeah, right. And so we had this whole birth plan that we had put together with her doctors. That it was really important to my wife, basically, that I not be in the trenches. She wanted me up near her head, holding her hand. She didn't want me to be in the fight, and I was fine with that. That seemed fine with me.
Right,
and then the day came on Thanksgiving when the hospital staff, a lot of people had the day off. So we kind of had to make do with a doctor who wasn't hers, and we had to adjust the plan. So I got to be the guy really right in there holding my wife's feet back so that the doctor could get into it.
Wow.
Which, to be honest, it wasn't upsetting or scary or gross like you tend to think when you're a kid. But you know what it was? It was exhausting. I mean, I'm sure it was tough on my wife, I guess. But it was exhausting.
It appeared to be difficult. Yeah. No, it's like, you know what? It's I don't know how you would describe that experience, but I mean, first of all, you've never seen anything like this in your life, right?
Yeah, and even if you saw the video in health class in high school, little preparation for
it. Ain't like yeah. that. And so you're sitting and you're sitting there watching all this, and you're just like, holy shit, man! This is how babies are born. And so your head's spinning. And, oh, by the way, it's going to be half you, and then your wife's there, and she's, like, going through her thing. And it's to say it's overwhelming, but it's overwhelming, in my opinion, overwhelming in an absolutely fascinating way. And, like, you look at this doctor, it's like, this is what you do every day. He's like, yep, this is part of what I do. I deliver babies. And, you know, and things like episiotomies, you hear about them, you know, and you see him and you stand there and he goes, now we'll do the episiotomy, and gets a needle out and he shoots Novocaine into the taint, right? And that's a technical medical word. And then he waits a few minutes and then he gets a pair of scissors out.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Really the only response you can have.
And you're watching it going, and he says, yeah, you know, we do this, you know, we don't want the baby to, you know, to rip your wife, you know.
It's easier to heal a cut than it is to heal a tear.
Right. And he's like a mechanic. He's like, so we're just, you know, giving the baby, you know, baby's head more room to get through and it makes it easier on your wife. But he takes a pair of scissors like he's cutting construction paper. And you're just like, he just did that.
The whole thing is surreal.
Right?
It's like, I mean, admittedly,
going to the zoo for the first time. Whoa.
It's like going to the zoo for the first time when you had never heard of any of the animals that are going to be there.
Right. You know? Right.
I have to say, though, you know, because my poor wife was in labor for 43 hours. And that was the biggest thing, is that the whole time that you're going through the labor process, honestly, the whole time that your wife is pregnant, you're waiting for the baby to arrive. But then when the baby finally does get there, you know, you're 43 hours into labor. She's exhausted. I was exhausted. The thing that you don't realize until that moment is that that's actually the beginning of the game.
Yeah.
The 9 months of exhaustion prior was nothing. That now you have this little human that you're supposed to keep alive, even though you've been on your feet for 43 hours, even though your wife just passed a watermelon, you know, all immediately. You guys need to be on your game. And I, you know, for movies, I thought that they would take my daughter to like a nice incubation room with like nice warm lights, and she would lay in there and I'd get to look at her through a window.
You're watching old movie, bros.
Yeah, none of that stuff happens. No, they just hand you the baby, right? And they start telling your wife to breastfeed.
But let me tell you this. Is there I don't know that there's a cooler moment when you've gone through all this stuff, right? And then the baby shows up, and they kind of take the baby and they put it right on your wife. And, you know, and as I said before, it appears to be an excruciating ordeal. But you see the look that her mother gets on her face when she has her baby next to her for the first time. You're like, forget about it, man.
Absolutely. You know,
right? It's one of the coolest. I mean, it's one of the coolest things you'll ever see in your life, right?
It's so cheesy to say that, but it's true. It's just like when I, you know, whenever I have a friend who is pregnant, I'm always like, honestly, being a dad is the coolest gig in the world, and I always feel like they think that I'm being disingenuous, like it's some kind of a Hallmark card platitude, but it's genuinely actually true that it really does change everything in a great way.
No,
you know, my best buddy's got a baby due in February. Not his first child, but he, you know, his first child lives in Canada with her mother, and he doesn't get to play that active a role in her life physically. He calls her every day and stuff. But, you know, so now he's going to have a baby in the house. And we were talking about it over the weekend. And honestly, it's like everything I say sounds like a Hallmark card. It all sounds like bullshit, but it's true. It's the coolest thing in the world. I love being a dad.
Let me tell you. And, you know, it's cooled your whole life. I mean, my kids, over the weekend, you know, I'm talking my oldest. He's in the Arctic Circle up in Norway with his with his Marines. And then my number two son just, you know, moved into his first house, and they've decorated it, and he's up on the roof putting on Christmas lights. And let me tell you, I used to call it special operations, right? We're in North Dakota. We're going up on the roof, and this house we lived in had a really steep roof. Oof. And it would have snow on it. And I would say, okay, we have to low crawl out to the end. I'll pound a nail in, and then we got to wrap the center part of the lights around that nail. And then we'll go get on the ladder, and then we'll pull it down to the corner of the house. And so I did the first year, and then I had my oldest son, who might have been 11 or 12. I had him do it, right? And so to get to the upper roof, you had to get on the lower roof to get to the upper roof. And then you had to low crawl out. And so then the upper roof was maybe 20 feet off the ground, so you'd have to get one of those long, tall ladders. And they would be up on the ladder, and there's, I don't know, 2 feet of snow on the ground. And they're putting up the lights, you know, and I start shaking the ladder, right? Right? And they're like, Dad! And I'm like, what, man? Anybody can do it when there's no pressure on. Can you do it when there's pressure on? And I am shaking the shit out of the ladder.
Honestly, that's the best part of being a dad.
Oh, my God.
I love this.
And they're yelling. I said, do it! Put the lights up! If I have to come up there, and so now they're trying to put the lights up. I'm shaking the shit out of the ladder. Then they're like coming down. I can't do this. And they're like coming down, and they get halfway, and then I really start shaking it, and they dive off at about the 6 foot mark, and they roll in the snow. And they're like, Dad, what is wrong with you? I'm like, really? Come here. You think you're a McNamara man? You get your ass back up there. I promise I won't shake it. And then I start shaking again.
And then I start shaking it. Exactly.
And let me tell you, I think the art of being a parent is turning nothing into incredible adventures. And putting the Christmas lights up is always one of them. My daughters grow up on the roof with me, right? And they love – I mean, we always have a great time with it. And even doing dishes in the kitchen after Thanksgiving, put music on and turn it up as loud as it will go. Shut the window so you don't piss off the neighbors. And be in the kitchen dancing, singing, and watch how much fun doing dishes turns into. And to me, that's the art of parenting. And there's no more fun you have on the planet.
And that's the best part of it. You know, my wife always says that that I'm really good at turning things into games.
Yes.
And I was like, well, little did you know, that's the way I've been doing it in my head for 35 some odd years. Now I just have an excuse to say it out loud, but I've always been tricking myself into trying to enjoy things I don't want to do. But yes, my daughter, you know, we took her to the zoo for her third birthday last Monday, and which we took her to kind of a smaller out of the way zoo because we thought, you know, there wouldn't be big crowds like there would be in Atlanta. We wouldn't have to deal with traffic. And that was all true. I won't name the zoo because it was terrible. But instead, we just ended up spending $150 to get into the zoo that my daughter was utterly disinterested in, other than there was a playground in the middle of the zoo. She wanted to go play in the playground. She could not care less about zebras or monkeys or anything like that. So I learned an important dad lesson. It's not how much money you spend on the birthday party. It's whether or not there's a slide, you know, or a set of swings.
Right. You know? Oh, my God. I have a great great video of I'm in Iraq. And Colleen might be three, so it's probably my second trip to Iraq. And she's sitting in the living room at a little kid table, right, on her little kid chair. And she's watching Dora the Explorer, I think. And my ex-wife says, say hello to Dad. And she looks at the camera, she goes, hi, Daddy. And then she looks and she says, could I have chocolate milk? She's like, Mommy, can I have chocolate milk? And she could have just said, like, can we change the oil in the car? Like, hello, Daddy. It was like nothing. And then she wants chocolate milk, right? And I've saved the video. I still have it, and I still watch it. And it's just a little girl watching cartoons, eating macaroni and cheese, and say hello to Daddy. Hi, Daddy. Can I have chocolate milk?
I love it, man. Because I save that kind of stuff too, but I love it all the more because you know how like my heart skips a beat every time I come on your show and I hear that intro with your daughter Colleen saying, with my dad, Mike McNamara. And, like every time it makes me think of the fact that one day my daughter is going to be able to say my name like that, you know? And it's mind-blower to me. It's already mind-blowing to me that my daughter's three. I feel like I just barely got home from the hospital. It really does fly by. But I think I deserve a little bit of credit. My wife didn't agree. But who would have ever thought I could keep a child alive for three full years? You know?
Well, hopefully you did before you had one. That's part of the self-reflection. Like, could I actually do this? But, you know, like I said, the best part is, you know, it goes on forever. You know, especially if you enjoy parenting, I had this incredible leadership discussion. It's, you know, with my oldest daughter about, you know,
how cool is that?
Man? Yeah, no, it's like she runs an office like that. What do you do when people just don't follow direction? I said, well, what
cool
I would do
by and, your daughter, man, right? You know, like,
oh, Catherine, man, she's a hard ass. I mean, and because my ex-wife is a hard ass, and in a good way. I mean, you know, when you're supposed to do something, you're supposed to do it. And we were like that with our kids, but we're like that at work too. Wait a minute. You were supposed to be done with this at this time. You didn't say anything, and now it's not done. Like, what are you doing? What are you thinking about? And so we had this conversation. I said, well, let me just tell you this. What I would do, the way I would approach it is, I don't know, has a whole lot of in common with the way you have to approach it, because the first thing you have to do as a civilian is you have to help them. Okay? So somebody's having a problem. The way you solve this is not, there's a difference between unfucking somebody and helping them. And
agreed.
And if you get a reputation for unfucking people, even though it may make the business run better, you will set the stopwatch to your time there, because at some point they're going to say, oh, you know, she's just so impersonal. I said, not that I've ever heard that in my life before. Just such a hard ass about everything. You know, I said, so there's an art to it, especially in the civilian world. So we had this really great conversation. I had another great conversation with my daughter Colleen when I told her, if you ever eat that much of the cherry pie I make again, Colleen, you'll be floating in the Santa Ana River along with both of our dogs. She's like, Dad. I'm like, okay, look, a lot of times I joke about stuff. I'm not joking about any of that, okay? She's like, okay. Colleen, when she eats a lot, she has this alter ego, her chubby alter ego that she calls Shelby.
She's named.
She has a name for her. She said, Shelby showed up. I said, okay, you tell Shelby she better keep her ass out of this house, all right? She's like, Dad, I don't know if I can. So, but, I mean, the whole thing, and again, even as they get older, the conversations get different, and they're always wonderful. So I'm with you, man. I think parenting is the coolest thing going on. What about, first of all, give us a health update with all the Hollings crew. I mean, your mom is a nurse, and so everybody.
Yeah, we're all a mess, right?
Is everybody good with COVID, or what's going on?
For the most part, yeah, things are going well. My mom is still working despite my repeated attempts to get her to retire. She was eligible for retirement last year and decided that she wanted to continue working to pay down her mortgage a bit more because she had bought a house recently. And then when COVID and everything hit, she tested positive, then she tested negative, then she tested positive for the antibodies. The poor woman had to effectively isolate herself for months. Even though we only live about 45 minutes away, you know, we might as well have been in different parts of the world. But at her nursing home right now, for the first time in a very long time, they do not have any positive COVID cases.
Wow.
Which is fantastic. You know, it really takes the stress off in that regard. However, unfortunately for me, COVID is just running rampant through my workplace. You know, a number of my peers on the marketing team, the CEO of our company, a couple of the other executives have all gone down with COVID in the past week or two. So far, we've been really lucky, though. Everybody's been sick. You know what? The worst, some people have been really pretty miserable, but none of us have been hospitalized or anything like that. So I'm counting my blessings, and I'm hoping for the best for the rest of my team, including Nicole, who's our content manager. So she does a lot of stuff for Sandbox News. So if you happen to notice things slowing down a little bit, it was in part because I took my first 4-day weekend since I was on active duty, and in part because poor Nicole is stuck in bed with the coronavirus.
Really?
So, and then you add all that up, and my kidneys just kind of stopped working a few weeks ago, and I'm still jumping through hoops about that.
Kidneys stopped working, like
they're not processing. I was working out really, really hard there for a couple of months, and I was doing, you know, 5 or 6 miles a day at lunch and lifting after work, and wasn't taking good care of myself otherwise. You know how, like, when you're 25, you can do that without adjusting anything else and there's no big deal.
Yes.
Apparently my method of only eating one meal a day and otherwise just pounding coffee, combined with doing 2-a-days, put my kidneys in a real bad place as of a few weeks ago. So I ended up in the hospital.
Wow.
It looks as though, however, kind of changing my dietary habits, my water habits, and my working out habits seemed to have my kidneys back running in the way they're supposed to be running. So hopefully I'll be working out again here in the near future. But it just goes to show how you kind of can't do the dumb stuff you did, you know, at 25 once you're past 30. Your body, like, actually needs water and, like, nutrients.
Well, yeah.
And stuff like this.
The coffee thing is most detrimental.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and, like, aside from just my caffeine intake being too high, you know, I have high blood pressure. I shouldn't have this much caffeine in me. But, you know, you see me and I look like a fairly fit guy. Turns out, though, the inside of my body is not running very properly. So, you know, I've got to make a couple adjustments to the way I take care of myself, in that I need to actually take care of myself. So here's hoping that I'll be back.
Well, you know, I will tell you this. I think you go through periods in your life, right, where you have kids and your career starting, and, you know, and I think you learn really – I think we all learn really bad – I hate to even use a term like this, but self-care habits in the Marine Corps. And essentially, we don't take care of ourselves.
100%.
You just push it and push it and push it and ignore it and ignore it and ignore it. And let me tell you, that is – in fact – I met a couple of Marines at about 3:13 in the morning about a month ago that called me after they had seen post-traumatic winning. And they came to dinner. They've been to my house now a couple times for dinner. And so one of them, on his way home from dinner the second time, on his motorcycle, gets hit by a car. He stopped at a stoplight, and the car doesn't see him and hits him from behind. Poof. And so he's got a back injury. And so he and I were just chatting yesterday, and I said, hey, man, I said, so how much longer do you have the brace on? He said, well, I don't know. I haven't, you know, the hospital hasn't released my CAT scan. And so the doctor in Balboa, I said, hey, when you go to work tomorrow, you throw a fucking fit about that shit, okay? I said, do you know how many friends I have that didn't appropriately take care of injuries in Iraq, Afghanistan, or even here at home?
100%.
And they didn't get it documented, and they didn't get it taken care of appropriately the first time, and they're going to deal with it for the rest of their lives now. And I said, and you can't do that with your back. I said, so I don't care who you have to throw a fit to, you know, military medicine will play you sideways for as long as you're willing to be played sideways. And I said, so if you have to get your chain of command involved in it, do it. And I said, and if you don't give me the right answer by Wednesday, I said, I know everybody in your battalion because I've spoken there four times. I said, I'm going to start some shit. Do you understand me? And then he went, yes, sir. And I said, all right. All right, we're where we need to be. I said, but no, honestly, you know, I know guys. I was talking to General Neller a couple months ago, and he said, you know, and he's asking me, he goes, hey, you were here when this happened. And he said, do you remember ID going off? Well, I said, I mean, God, they went off every day. I said, I don't remember that specific incident. He said, well, this guy called me and asked me if I can help him, but he never went to medical, and now he's got a traumatic brain injury. But there's a record of the vehicle hitting an ID, but there's nothing else.
Yeah.
And he said, so now you have to go through this incredibly laborious and dicey appeals process trying to get this thing connected to you. And
the appeals process alone can take 3 years. I know. Yeah. I've been going through one. I was medically retired because of my knees. Then I missed one medical appointment and the VA stopped. They said that they've reduced the disability for my knees to 0% because it must have resolved itself. So because of that one thing, I filed an appeal, and I'm a year and a half in, and I don't expect a result anytime soon. So you're totally right. And you know what? He's so lucky to have a guy like you to kind of not just explain that to him, but to give him that impetus. For me, it was a guy named First Sergeant Owens. I haven't been in touch with him. I hope he became Sergeant Major Owens. He was on George W. Bush's security detail. He was the motivating first sergeant. You know how you can have first sergeants that you hope you don't run into and first sergeants that you hope you do? First Sergeant Owens was that first sergeant that you hope you do run into, even if it's a bad day, even if you're screwed up today. First Sergeant Owens was a problem solver, you know? And I was getting near the end of my contract. I was trying to re-enlist, but there was a bunch of big medical question marks. And First Sergeant Owens said, well, hey, have you talked to the VA? If you're going to end up being separated, or have you talked about getting your disability percentage before you separate from service?
Which is really, really smart because you go straight to the front of the line if you do it that way.
Exactly. And I not only did I not know anything about that at the time, I wasn't comfortable with in my last duty station, I was on a next of kin notification and a funeral honors detail. And also dealt a lot with Marines that had been hurt overseas, and now their family is somewhere in the Massachusetts area, so we've got them in hospitals in the Massachusetts system. So, you know, I'd see guys every day with no legs, you know, and I buried heroes once a week. And I just felt entirely uncomfortable with going to the VA to say, hey, yeah, my knees got jacked up while I was in the Marine Corps. You know, I had this metal screen put in my stomach. But compared to the guys I saw every day, it really seemed like I had no right, you know. Right. And it was first.
You know,
get your ass in that room.
A lot of guys do that. It's like, hey, look, you know, compared to other people, I got that. But let me tell you, this is business. I remember. You're gonna laugh at me, but I remember I went going through TAP as a major at the San Luis Rey. It was formerly an officer club. Now it's just a meeting facility aboard Camp Pendleton. And so they have the disabled American veterans and the American Legion guys and the VFW guys there. And you go, you know, they all have a table and you go meet with them. And so I think the guy was either a DAV guy or a VFW guy. So he's looking through my medical record and stuff. And he said, he goes, have you been screened for PTSD? And I said, yeah, but I, you know. And he starts looking through my medical record and he says, explain this to me. And I said, well, I mean, there's a helicopter crash, you know, one guy decapitated. He looks at me, he goes, and I said, look, but I don't need that stuff. I don't, you know, with exactly the same sentiment that you had. I know people that saw a lot worse than I ever saw. And the guy just, he sits, he puts my book down and he looks at me. And this guy's probably in his, you know, probably in his late 60s. And he says, Mac, look, why don't you just answer my questions, all right, and save your opinions for later. Okay, I do this for a living. I said, gotcha. And so he goes through, he goes, look, man, before we even get to, you know, your deployed time in Iraq and Afghanistan, you rate the rating if you saw somebody decapitated and went and found his head. And
the, honestly, it's true, because the biggest thing I didn't think of then, and I'm sure you didn't either, is that this rating isn't about you today.
Right.
It's about you every day right. for the rest of your life.
And, but you don't know that. And what's in your head.
You don't know that.
What's in your head, especially in the last 20 years, right, was all the people that you know that are struggling with worse things. And it's like, I'm not that guy. You know, I don't. And then.
Absolutely.
Then if you, and again, as you said, and I, that's what I was trying to be for, you know, it's Lance Corporal, right? And by just doing the same thing that somebody had done for me previously that made me smart about, no, you need to get this taken care of. You need to get it documented and don't be stupid, because I think Marines have this tendency, right? Especially if you're part of the rough and tumble set. Fuck it. Yeah, let's go.
Honestly. And I took a lot of pride in that.
Oh, you know, we do.
Took tons of pride in training hurt, you know, I'm always the guy who says, even on limited duty, I had a first class PFT. I took a ton of pride in being that asshole. Now, as a dad, though, and my wife laughs at me all the time because I always tell my daughter, she's three, you know, she's made out of rubber bands. You could throw her out a window and she'd be fine. But every time I see her take a nasty tumble onto her knees, I'm like, hey, kid, you're going to need those knees for a while. I didn't think you did. People told me when I was a kid, when I was playing football, when I was playing rugby, everybody told me my whole life, hey, if you abuse your knees, you are going to regret it. And now I'm 35 and I limp. You know, these people are right. You should pay attention.
You know, when I was a kid, we'd fall down and stuff like that. My dad, you know, he'd say, hey, come here. And he'd spit in his hand and then he'd rub it. He goes, go get him.
Yep.
So, I mean, as a little guy, right? I was like, that'll be all right. Do you need stitches for that? Probably, but not really. It'll heal. Right? And so you grow up like that, and then your injuries become, you know, and sad is when, you know, you apply that to a traumatic brain injury, you apply it, you know, to all kinds of stuff, and then, you know, you're having to go through years worth of documentation in order to, you know, get the help that you should have got from the get-go, except you wanted to be a player. You didn't want to be a cheese ball. You didn't want to cheese out of stuff. And that's all part of our pride. And it's honestly, I say this thing in post-traumatic winning. I said, you want to know what makes the Marine Corps different? I said, first of all, ask any professional recruiter what they think of the slogan, maybe you could be one of us, the few, the proud. As a recruiter, ask them what they think of that. And you know what they're going to tell you? It sucks, man. You just alienated like 2/3 of the population that are intimidated by your shit-talking recruiting slogan. But what that does attract ultimately are people that either are tough or want to be tough or aren't afraid of a challenge. And
honestly,
that's
how my recruiter got me. I said, will you give me a bonus? And he said, why would I? We don't need you.
Right.
And I was like, oh, shit. All right. I need the papers. I'm going to prove you wrong.
No, but it is. And again, you know, the recruit training officer candidate school, I mean, it roughs us up. It teaches us different words and terms we've never heard before and all that kind of good stuff. But what makes it unique is when you challenge that group, they're born conquering challenges. They're tough people. You know, a lot of Marines are tough people. And I have this whole thesis I'm working on that, you know, I've seen statistics relative to people in the all-volunteer force. 43% said that they were raised in abusive homes. 37% said there was alcohol abused in their home. 24% said that there was domestic violence in their home. 12% that said somebody was incarcerated in their home. And 11% said they were touched sexually in their home. I would tell you, for Marines who tend to be tougher, every one of those numbers is higher. Mm-hmm. That's my instinct, okay? Now, because it spawned the question in my head. What spawns a young person to be tough?
Honestly, hardship.
Hardship does, exactly. So if you're gravitating to a force that its primary characteristic is we're tough, man. We are relentless and we are tough. And you come from a life that you've had to be tough, you're like, I want a piece of that. Or maybe you aren't so tough, but you want to be because you've always hated that about your life. I haven't been tough in my life, but I want to be. And what does that longing come from? I've not really handled the toughness that's been required of me very well, so I want to be. So it's a pretty – and I would tell you this, Alex. As leaders, we don't know who's standing in front of us. We don't know that. We don't know how much of that formation comes from that background. Interesting.
Honestly, there's one other facet of this that I fell victim to. I walked right into like an idiot that I wish other people would not. And that is when you come to define yourself through that toughness, which is why I played football my whole life, why I played rugby in college, why I joined the Marines, why I fought in cages. It was all about earning that tough sticker, you know? Right. And a big part of that is overcoming injury, you know? And I had plenty of injuries through all those different things, and I always took a lot of pride in how quickly I had bounced back and how much I could do even while hurt. But the problem with using that toughness to define who you are in your head is that eventually when things start to slow down, like when I was medically separated from the Marine Corps, I had, you know, 7 surgeries over 2 years. I couldn't do much for a long time. And I found myself in a bad place because I had defined myself for so long by these injuries that I was overcoming that once I wasn't overcoming them anymore, all I had left were the injuries. And it put me in a really bad place. I felt as though I didn't have value anymore because for so long I had associated my value with my ability to overcome injury, to be a tough guy. And eventually being a tough guy doesn't help anymore. You know, whether you're 60 years old and you finally get put behind a desk for the first time in your career, or you're 35 and you got a bum ankle now, so you've got to take a different job. Eventually there comes a time where being the tough guy isn't going to solve all your problems anymore. But if you've spent your whole life to that point, right, defining yourself as that tough guy, you're going to find yourself not well positioned for that transition. That was a big deal for me. It took me finding writing, I would argue, for me to realize that I don't have to be the toughest guy in the room to have any value. You know, you have to remember that there's more to you than toughness. Toughness is a very important, very valuable trait, but don't let it define you. Let toughness be one of your tools, you know, and if you have it as a tool, you'll always be successful. But if you score yourself only on toughness, there's going to come a point for every one of us when we're just not as tough as we used to be. There's still lots left to do, you know, but you can find yourself in a really bad place because you feel as though you can't do anything anymore. Just because you can't, you know, run through concrete walls like you used to.
Well, let me tell you where I think, you know, let me ask you a trivia question. Can you tell me what age group has the highest suicide rate among veterans? And I'll give you some choices. 18 to 34, 35 to 54, 55 to 74, or over 75?
I'm inclined to say it's one of the earlier ones. I want to say probably either the 18 to 34 or the 35 up one.
55 to 74 by a significant amount.
Wow, really?
So here's my thesis. I believe that many of us get damaged when we're young. And then as we go through life, and some of us are civilians, some of us are adult or in the military, we add to that stack. We go looking for help. We don't find it. We reject it, and we stop going to counseling, and we're kind of groping in the dark. Many of us self-medicate with alcohol and some with drugs. And I think the OxyContin epidemic in the country is part of this problem.
I would buy that for sure.
And then life slowly but surely puts more plates on us until at some point we say, I can't do it anymore. All I see in front of me is blackness. I don't see it getting better. And so the veteran suicide number that spikes between 55 and 74 is a long, gradual slide of frustration, of inability to deal with issues, of not seeing a path. And it's a very, very interesting thing to kind of, when you back the lens out and not just talk about active duty suicide or young. And it's really surprising to most people that when you look at those VA numbers of suicide, because everybody believes our suicide has to do with combat. And I would tell you, it does not. It does not. Combat's a factor in it. But most of the people I know that killed themselves that had gone to combat had other things that I would call structural damage before they went. And this was another plate we put on top of it and accelerated the downward spiral that they were already in.
I can't agree more.
Yeah. But I would tell you, to me, the work I do has gone from fascinating to even more fascinating, because I believe there's a remedy to this. And the greatest, as I say, the greatest remedy the Marine Corps has is whenever something goes wrong, humanitarian assistance or whatever, send Marines in there and tell them to do good things and watch what they do. And so people ask me, like, Mac, why is this thing that you do so have such an impact on numbers? The last major subordinate command, I did it within January, suicide attempts are down 65%. In the COVID year when everything is up, right? And I say, look, if you tell Marines the truth and you challenge them, get out of their way and watch what they do. I said, that's what I do. I tell them, I'm here to tell you the truth, and if you don't like it, I don't give a fuck. Okay? But this is the truth. And let me tell you, all they do is they go help people and they do good things. Because this flat, black, traumatic wisdom that I lay on them, it's no bullshit, and they know it. So I don't sugarcoat shit. And then they do the same thing they do with everything they touch, is they go do good things. Because the DNA is really, really good fucking DNA. But if you broaden the lens and look at it as, where does this desire to be tough come from? And you hit it right on the head. Because I needed to be tough. Because my life was tough. And I was, you know, that's how I got through it. Toughness was part of it, right? So to me, and then what's amazing is, I'll ask people in leadership positions, do you have any idea, does anybody keep any of these statistics? No, I've never seen anything like that. And so we don't even know who we're talking to. How many of the people in that formation, you know, have been impacted by this shit, and how many people have been impacted by multiple boxes in that set of emotional abuse, alcohol abuse, domestic violence, right? Somebody incarcerated, you know, sexual, you know, abuse.
Absolutely. I think, was it four things you listed? As you listed them, the sexual abuse one was the only one that I didn't get to check off my list. Every one of the rest, you know, hit me for a T. And it makes you wonder, okay, how many of the rest of us?
Right. Right. Hello. And so it's like, okay, so what happens is they come looking for a certain amount of leadership. If they get Lord of the Flies and not a leader like you were talking about, your first sergeant, right? If they get the Lord of the Flies version of some senior lance corporal or corporal doing his, you know, drill instructor impersonation, dude, you're more fragile. And I'd like to say that we have the tools, but we don't have the tools. And then they go to mental health. And again, a lot of times they don't get what they meet a mental health person that's trying to do the Freudian thing on them. They don't need Freud. They don't have a serious mental illness. What they need is a coach. They need your first sergeant. They need you with that steadying palm, that meat hook on the shoulder and say, look at me. You can get through this. We're going to teach you. All right? Now, but there's some rules, and you're going to play by the rules. And if you play by the rules, I promise you, you can get through anything. You got it? Like, holy shit. Thanks, Sergeant. And then you teach them. They need a coach. They need a mentor to get through this shit. They don't need, in my opinion, they don't need, neither do they respond to, how does that make you feel? How does that make you feel? How does that make you feel? Here, hold these two rocks in your hands. Now switch them. They stop
going. Totally right.
They stop going to that stuff. And they, again, I would say, I don't want to say 100%, but a really high percentage of what I hear is, I went and I hated it. I just stopped going. I waited till we went to the field. I canceled the appointment, and then I just prayed they'd never call the company office so I wouldn't get in trouble. I'm not going back to that. Didn't help me. So it's really interesting. It's really interesting.
I agree, and honestly, especially because we know statistically that counseling in conjunction with drugs is the most effective way to combat suicidal idea, or suicide or severe depression. Medication alone it's very unlikely you're going to take a handful of pills and do better. The vast majority of people who take antidepressant or anti-anxiety medication because of severe depression or severe anxiety, it scores only slightly better than placebo in studies.
Right. I would tell you this, Alex. I have this thing that I say. It's like, look, you can't medicate yourself to a great place.
Okay. You can't.
You can't.
You can't. But, and this is coming from a guy, I am medicated.
Right. No, but I say this. But medication may be part of getting you there. Okay? You can't talk. What are the right words to say? What are the key words? Right? What sequence do I say it in to talk seeing somebody decapitated into something good? Answer, you can't. Okay? But talking about it is certainly part of getting to a great place. Okay? And so that's what I love about what I do is that, look, the way to go to a great place is embrace this flat black traumatic wisdom, these three goals and 10 commandments, right? And these commandments, they're the path. And it's like, it's all these flat black. If you've ever seen like one of our impromptu memorials up at Camp Pendleton, or you've ever seen at the top of Mount Suribachi, there's all these rank insignia there, right? And the majority of it is enlisted. So there's just piles of flat black rank insignia. I said, this path looks like that. It's a black path, but then when you get on top of it and you look down, it's PFC Chevron, Master Gunnery Sergeant Chevron, Gunny Chevron, Corporal Chevron, Sergeant Chevron. And there's way more E5 and below than anything else, okay? And that's this path. The rails on it are, got to learn to coexist, and you got to live with self-discipline. And then the placard in front of you that keeps moving as you move down the road is, if you keep giving this and helping people, you will change the way you feel about the things that have created this desire to be tough, which is essentially your trauma. And then as you give to more people and you create joyful experiences, joy, not trauma, will become the dominant experience and emotion in your life.
I mean, you're very literally reframing your trauma into a tool,
right?
You know,
absolutely. And so they listen to it, and they're like, "Fuck, I could." And then like, okay, I want you to listen to this, to meet this Lance Corporal. I meet this sergeant. Meet this civilian. Meet this Lance Corporal's mom who taught me this shit. Okay, like I thought I was giving you information. What she taught me was I changed everybody's life in her family. I didn't realize even what I was doing. And then that night I couldn't go to sleep. And so to me, when you begin to, you got to back the lens out. And then you see this thing, what's happening is they're going to mental health. They're going to mental health. They're not finding what they need. And whether they stay in or get out, they tend to be alone, faking it, or self-medicating with alcohol and groping for something that works for them. And I think you're absolutely typical of this group, Alex, right? You're a tough guy. You're by yourself. You can handle this. But it gets really fucking heavy and really fucking lonely a lot of the times, especially when you're dealing with a lot of heavy shit.
You're 100% right. In my case, I was super fortunate. You know, I was when I was at my worst, I had a phone number to call. You know, we had a psychological health team attached to our unit. I was going through a tough time that had nothing to do with the Marine Corps at the time. My wife and I were going through trouble that in conjunction with another knee surgery, in conjunction with a big MCAT inspection and whatever. It was that I felt like I was all by myself, and it felt like the path ahead was just dark. Black, I called my psychological health team, and the difference I would say between like my regimental PHOP and going to a therapist out in the private world is probably that my psychological health team, although they were civilian counselors, they dealt specifically with Marines all the time, and they didn't offer me those generic platitudes that would have immediately turned me off. You know, like you're saying, if you're not honest, you know, if there was a post-traumatic winning, if there was a Mike McNamara, right, I could have called at that point. Right. That worked for me. Right. But when I tried to do the generic, you're just trying to feel better in a bad time stuff, it all felt fake and like bullshit.
It is, because it is.
I wasn't in that position because I had some chemical problem in my brain. It was circumstantial. You know, it was my environment. It was decisions that I had made that put me in a bad place. It was, you know, a rocky marriage because we got married super young, and, you know, a million things that were all practical issues that needed to be addressed. I didn't need to medicate them away. I didn't need to go sit with a counselor to find out about which parts of my personality are my dad's fault.
Oh, my God. I have this hilarious piece of comedy that I do now. So I say, look, and so some days I'll struggle to do this, right? Because, I mean, I talk about all these different things in my life. And I get this part where my gunny, I say, look, the thing that launched me down this road is my gunny telling me I'm never going to get over this stuff after the helicopter crash where, you know, one Marine's decapitated and three others are killed, right? And I'm in the middle of it. And so I'm standing up here today, and I remember this is last week. I'm doing pretty good. But, you know, if I was struggling, I wouldn't give two fucks about what you guys thought. You want to know why? Because my gunny told me there was nothing wrong with me, and I'd struggle with this for the rest of my life. So fuck y'all. And so they all started laughing, right? And I said, now, I could probably spend a couple hundred grand of some insurance company's money to go to a therapist that would give me their opinion of what was wrong with me and why I get emotional. And it would sound something like this. Well, Mac, you know, you've been coming to me for 4 months, and I think I can give you an explanation of, you know, why you do get so emotional some days on this thing. I'm like, okay, doc, what is it? Well, honestly, you want to have sex with your mother. Right? Right? To which I would respond, well, I guess I should be glad it wasn't my dad or my dog, right, doc? So what the fuck do we do about it? Oh, well, that's a very interesting and different question. We'll have to give that a lot of thought. And like I don't honestly, give a shit what they have to say.
You're so right that it's painful. I go to therapy every week, and it took me a while to find a counselor. That's because I very specifically, I was like, I want a behavioral health person. I want somebody who's going to give me homework. Tell me what it is
work
that
with
I need
me,
to
do right?
tomorrow better. I don't give a shit about yesterday. My dad made plenty of mistakes, sure. You know, I had a bit of a tough childhood, sure. I've gone through some things as an adult, sure. Nothing that we talk about in this room is going to take any of that away or change any of that. I want practical things that I can do tomorrow, that I can do this afternoon, so that when I'm struggling, when I'm in a bad place, I know what to do. I've got a checklist of things to do. That's the way my brain works. You know, maybe there are other people out there where they get a ton of value out of analyzing their childhood or really delving deep into those traumatic experiences. I'm not saying don't do that. Right. But for me, right, I need something that I can go, all right, I'm having a bad day today. These are the three things I can do that I know will help me get through it. You know, that's my take on it. I take medication, and I always encourage people, if your doctor recommends it, take medication, but pills are never going to solve your problem. The best you can get out of pills.
Dude, that's the two primary treatment protocols. Both, I mean, that's how we do it.
The way that I look at taking medication for depression is consider your emotional health as like a spectrum from negative 10 to positive 10, right? So maybe positive 10 is winning the lottery. You won the Powerball, and now you've just won $300 million. And maybe negative 10 is, you know, watching your spouse die in front of you in a train crash. the worst thing you can imagine. Zero in the middle is just nothing. You know, a regular day before you've had a chance to make your day good or bad. If you're floating around a negative seven all the time because you're just chemically balanced that way, medication might help you get up to a negative three, you know, maybe a negative four. Medication may help take the edge off of it so that you can take practical steps yourself to improve where you are and what you're doing. Let's say you're floating around at like a negative three and you just really want to be indifferent or happy. You're probably not going to get it out of medication. You may at very best, if the trouble that you're dealing with is fairly minor, you may at the very best be able to medicate yourself to a flat zero where you just don't feel anything.
But again, the key is getting beyond the medication. So when you have a conversation about the medication, you have to have a grown-up conversation about, hey, doc, so how long am I going to be on this? You know,
is your spotter.
Right. When do you see me getting off this? Blah, 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 blah. But we don't have those conversations because whenever we go to the doctors, all we do is lie to the doctor. How do you feel? Yep. I feel great.
I'm fine.
And the doctor can't help you if you don't tell him the fucking truth.
I'm guilty of it myself.
Dude, men are the worst. Women are better because they grow up, their body's more complicated, right? And they're more mature. So I always tell men, okay, I'm talking to all the dudes here right now. You suck as a patient, okay?
Yeah.
So whenever you go to the doctor and something gets problematic or harder, think to yourself, what would a woman do in this situation? And then do what a woman would do, okay? Because here's what we do. We lie. We lie so we don't have to go. We lie about how we feel.
You won't tell them how much you're actually drinking.
Right.
You won't tell them how little you're actually sleeping.
Dude, there's a quote.
You won't tell them about your coping mechanisms.
There's a quote in Post-Traumatic Winning. When you actually stop lying to the doctor, by a sergeant by the name of Ross Pape, 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, family friend of mine, when you actually, both of his brothers were killed after combat deployments here in the United States, one in a motorcycle accident, one in a static line, night jump, parachute, training jump at Camp Pendleton. They were supposed to go farm together in Minnesota, and together, now he farms by himself. And he essentially tries to drink himself to death. And he said, when you finally stop lying to the doctor about how much you drink in a day, in a week, and you tell him, yeah, I used to drink, you know, 3 or 4 cases of beer a week. And he said, and then you actually do what they tell you to do, it actually starts to friggin' work. I mean, the words straight from your mouth. But they can't help you if you won't let them in. And this is advice that goes across the board, because it's the same thing with the first commandment is stop faking it. And I show a video of Gene Sledge. And he writes that book with the old breed, and his wife types it. You know, that's essentially letting her into this world that he lived in. And do you think it changes their relationship? You bet it fucking does. And you see these, you know, a friend of mine named Ken Rogers who made the documentary, he's a Quezon guy. I mean, he came home and got drunk for 30 years. And he said, when I mean drunk, I mean a case of beer a day and a bottle of wine at night or a half a fifth of whiskey at night. I mean,
I'm telling you, I watched my dad do it. My dad came home from Vietnam and just kept a bottle of Black Velvet in his closet for the rest of forever.
Right.
Until one day it led to a stroke where he didn't know his name anymore.
Right.
You know?
And so all we do is lie so we don't have to go. And so the trick
is – father worked in healthcare.
Well, think about you. Think about you, Alex. So if you didn't have your wife in your life, right,
I'd be in a darker place. I can, to speak exactly to what you were saying about OxyContin. You know, I had 7 surgeries on my way out of the Marine Corps. Every surgery came from a different orthopedic doctor. Every orthopedic doctor was happy to give me a different prescription. For a while there,
the DA and the VA, when they give you medications, do they give you just a little bit?
No, they'll give me a. At one point, I think I had 3 different 30-day supplies of opiates that were prescribed to me because I had surgeries in quick succession. So one was from the hernia doctor, one was from the knee doctor, one was from the ankle doctor. And to be honest, I didn't think there was anything wrong with that at all. I started out, you know, taking these pills because the doctor said to. Right. Then I would take these pills because whatever it was would hurt. Then I would take these pills to make sure it didn't start hurting. And then I came to this point where my wife was like, you know, I know every 4 hours it says you can take these pills, but like, you're just doing that. You haven't talked at all about, you know, your knees hurting, you know, it seems to me like you're just taking these medications on autopilot, and it hadn't even crossed my mind. And, as a result of that conversation alone changed the entire trajectory of my life. If not, but for the grace of God, go I. I'm not a big God guy, but it's hard for me to look at veterans who are struggling with addiction and not go, yeah, man, that totally could have been me.
Right. No. Again, it is the road we travel down. And I tell people, look, I'd like to tell you that I meet a lot of Marines and a lot of veterans that say, you know, no, I've gone, you know, I went through this stuff. I went to therapy and it really helped me. I said, I don't meet people like that. And I know they're out there. I don't meet anybody who has an enduring relationship with a therapist. So, you know, so when I give advice, I say, look, so the first person you should talk to is your spouse. And if you don't think they can hear you about your shit, you're full of shit. Okay? Look, and maybe they don't need to hear 100% of it the first time. But if the details are important to you, you've got to go there with them. Because
and that's the toughest conversation with the spouse.
Oh my God!
It gives you that social obligation to take the next step, because then you have support,
right,
and someone who's going to hold you accountable.
Well, and the other thing, Alex, you've lived this. You know, if human beings have a requirement for intimacy, and I don't mean sexual at this point, although in a relationship it's certainly part of it. But what I mean is feeling close to somebody, feeling connected to somebody, feeling, you know, like when they flop down next to the couch, you're watching a game next to you on the couch, they throw their leg over you, they pull out their phone, they're like, who's winning? And you say, the Yankees are losing, this isn't good. But just that connection and that cool warmth that you feel with that's intimacy between you and somebody else. If humans need that, you need it more after you go through traumatic experiences. No doubt in my mind. You crave it, this connection. And when you don't open the door, and we don't, and what we tend to say is, because I love you, I'll never go there with you. That's what we fucking say. And it's the stupidest shit in the world. And so we self-imprison. We put ourselves in that place. But
that's a really good way to put it. It is. It's self-imprisonment.
But that's you're 100% right. That's what we think we're supposed to do, because real men don't talk about this shit. Right.
Well, you know, there's a romance to the idea of being miserable, you know. As a writer, when I was younger, before I was doing journalism, I was just writing fiction. Like that idea of the troubled writer, you know, who they pour your heart out onto the page, and otherwise you're just going to Charles Bukowski your way through life. And if you're not familiar with Bukowski, he's like if Hunter S. Thompson had depression, right? and there's a romance to that idea of being like the salty old man who's just too tortured to share, right? The truth is, though, that salty old man's fucking miserable. Nobody wants to be that man. When you watch The Unforgiven, Clint Eastwood seems awesome. But nobody actually wants to be Clint Eastwood in The Unforgiven. It might seem cool from the outside, but from the inside, it sucks. There's nothing good that'll come of that. You know, Mac is right. It's a prison of your own making. It really is.
But it's what we – and I always – I use a fair amount of humor that's laced with some truth in post-traumatic winning. I say, you know – and you know who I blame for this? Our grandmothers. You know, your grandfather fought in World War II. He never talked about it. Got it, Grandma. Thank you. Uncle Larry, he fought in Vietnam. He never talked about it. Yeah, Grandma. Uncle Larry's been drunk for 50 years and since he came home, and we don't even see him or know if he's alive anymore. That's beside the point. He never talked about it, right? Okay, so, you know, you go to Iraq, Afghanistan, wherever, Somalia, Syria, wherever the fuck you go, you come home. Are you supposed to talk about it? No, fuck no. Men don't do that. And why am I biased like that? Well, because I've heard other veterans talk, and I've also heard my grandmother talk. And that's how you're supposed to. And again, that's where the because I love you, I'll never go there with you. Are you fucking kidding me? You know, and I think it's this self, like, you know, combat trauma is so different from every other form of trauma. Oh, really? You want to meet my sister? You know? Yeah. I don't think any of us saw any of our kids shot and murdered. You want to meet Elizabeth Smart, who was raped for 9 years? So you don't. So you think you've cornered the market and nobody could understand you? Fuck you, man. You're so full of shit. And that those are the conversations we need to have. Bullshit, man. Try it and see what happens. And your whole life changes when you get over yourself. But again, this cult that we join, these things that we believe in, all kind of steer us in this direction of isolation. And the facey movement to the door that leads to really bad shit in life is isolation. If you don't isolate yourself, if you stay connected, if you're not afraid to talk, and again, I hate this. All this shit is so unmarine-like, too. If you're not afraid to be vulnerable and talk about your shit, if you'll be gentle with yourself knowing that you're going to struggle some days, you can get through anything. I know that because I see people do it all the time. But there's another path. It's a dark path. And you know what and what these drugs do and what going to therapy that really doesn't have an end state that's positive, you just talk about your shit, that is what I call endurance. And at some point, endurance gets too hard and too old and too tired, and it collapses because one too many plates got stuck on. I just couldn't do it anymore. And so there's got to be a better way than endurance, and that's what post-traumatic winning is. There is a better way, and that is selfless, doing the same things that you're talking about, Alex, the way you take care of Marines and stuff like that. Do that for people. Do that for everybody who you cross paths with. All you got to do is say, hey, man, can I talk to you? I heard what you were talking about, and I'd like to show you some shit from my culture, and I think it would really help you. And when you do that all the time, and you have people calling you and say, hey, dude, the only reason I think I'm still alive is because of you. Yeah, put that one in your pipe and smoke it, right? Try to be miserable with that kind of shit in your life on a relatively regular basis. And I will tell you this, and Alex, you know this, you don't have to go looking for it. It's fucking everywhere. It is everywhere around you.
And let me tell you, there's a big difference between getting a phone call on a random Thursday saying, hey, I don't think I'd still be here if it weren't for you. There's a big difference between that and losing that Marine, losing that friend, and having him come to mind on a random Thursday where you wonder if he'd still be here if it weren't for you. Reach out to people. You know, I've got a laundry list at this point of Marines that – you wonder if they'd still be here if we had just talked about things a little bit.
Let me just tell you, there's no doubt in my mind they would. And that's one of my great frustrations is I have guys come up to me and say, I wish my friend could have seen this. I'd probably still be alive. And I know, and I don't say anything but I know they would. I know they would be. And how do I know that? Because I see it all the fucking time. All the time.
Honestly,
these people. That you know, I did post-traumatic winning like 10 times in the last 2 weeks with 7th ESB and out here and with 3-5. And all these young people, you know, not all young, all these Marines and sailors come up and to talk. And then they call me at my house. And it's, my mom was almost murdered by her brother. Do you think you could help her? Yes, we can help her. The credibility is going to come from, because your mom is going to immediately say what everybody says, like, this bullshit, I don't want to talk to this dude, or I don't want to entertain this stuff. But when you look her in the face and you say, Mom, have I ever brought this stuff to you before? No. I promise you that this will help you. I promise you this is not like anything you've ever seen. That credibility opens a door. And then what holds the door open is the flat, black, traumatic wisdom, right? And Alex only lived in the flat, black, shallow end of the pool where there is no bullshit, right? In the world of sergeant to lance, corporal, PFC, private, you try to run bullshit on them and you'll get thrown off the second or third floor of the barracks. They don't fucking play that game, right?
Absolutely. Honestly.
not a fucking bit, right? And so when you hear the flat, black, traumatic wisdom of stop faking it, right? That it is going to happen to you in life. It's all shit that I've collected from them. And then I tell everybody, that's what keeps the door open. Because they're not going to look at anything and say, that's bullshit. And they're not going to hear bullshit. And that makes them interested. Like, well, what is this stuff? And then when you tell them, look, if you don't embrace self-discipline, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to fuck your life up for constantly forever. And then, you know, then they say, okay, well, how about if I stop except for special occasions? Okay, let's start there. And so you have – and the, so it's held open by the truth. And then when you say, and then, Mom, you and I need to help Aunt so-and-so. Because a lot of time what people won't do for themselves, they'll do for somebody else. But, Mom, you've got to see this. You've got to understand this. And we've got to have – we've got to talk about some stuff. And then I want you and me to talk to, you know, Aunt Dorothy. Oh, my God. And then when you – when she changes Aunt Dorothy's life, forget about it. She's experienced the magic of linking her pain to something positive, to changing somebody else's life, that now you have this bow wave of joy that crashes over the trauma and you're breaking it up. And that's the key to it. That's the path. And that's what I love about this flat black traumatic wisdom. It's no bullshit, man. It's look them straight in the face and tell them the truth. And then this is where your life can go. And I know you don't think it can go there, but I'm fucking telling you it can. And then they go
and you know, honestly, and do it. Consider it as much a responsibility, and an obligation to your team, fellow Marines, to the guys that were in your squad, as it is to yourself. Statistically, it's proven that if one person within your social unit, within your military unit, commits suicide, the chances that you'll commit suicide yourself go up. You know, the chances that other people will commit suicide go up. One of the hardest things I have ever had to do in my life is cut somebody's dress blues jacket in half so that we could slide it over his body so that he could be buried in it. You know, that's a guy who thought that he was solving problems. You know, he didn't solve his problems and he didn't solve any of ours. The thing that you have to remember when you're finally kind of nutting up to go talk to the doctor, when you're finally getting the courage to go talk to your wife or to your mom, when you're finally deciding that you're going to talk about it, it's hard to do that for you because nobody wants to do anything for them. You know, nobody, it feels almost selfish even to say, I'm going to do this for me. Like Max said, self-care is like a phrase that Marines in particular just kind of shy away from because it sounds so counterintuitive to who we are and what we do. But the truth is, look at it from a readiness standpoint. You are not any good in the fight if your brain is elsewhere. Your team is not any good in a fight if they're worried about you. If it's been 40 years since you've been in a fight, your team still matters and they're still counting on you to keep your shit together. Don't do it as a favor to yourself. Do it as an obligation, as a responsibility to your peers. Because if you go down, if you decide that you're going to take your life, you are increasing the likelihood that your teammates are going to too. Somebody else on your team is going to kill themselves because you took that easy way out and they saw it happen. And instead of staying here and dealing with that extra plate that you just handed them, they're going to take that plate and whatever other plates get added to their load this year, and they might be the next one to go because instead of helping yourself, you decided to push that weight off onto them.
Now, and let me tell you, I would tell you that that's avoiding the negative. And here's the other half of this is, and I'd say the more significant part is, because we don't know that there's a path through all this darkness to us, because we, you know, the primary treatment protocols from the DOD and the VA are essentially, you know, medication and then talk therapy. And they're not teaching transformation or how to use this to help other people and how to do that. They won't teach that, right? Because at the end of the day, right, big medicine.
It's a bad business model.
Right? Big medicine is about liability, right? So it's this diagnosis linked to this code, linked to these medication codes and these treatment codes. Nobody gets sued. Well, does that help Hollings? Well, it's supposed to. Well, when you read a study done by NYU's School of Medicine that says 50 to 66% of patients that use the two primary treatment protocols that the VA and the DOD uses don't show any improvement, 50 to 66%. What does that tell you? And again, what I'll tell you is mental health is hard. It ain't easy. And I don't blame the mental health providers. But what I tell you is this, is that avoiding the negative is only part of it. When you look at somebody and say, after they help somebody else, this is from a corporal who watched his mother die at the age of 11. This last Christmas, sitting in a bar with friends from high school. He's now 23. Girl sitting across from me got raped when she was a junior. And we were just talking, and she was talking about how frustrated she is that she hasn't been able to make more progress. She feels like she's kind of still stuck. And so, you know, we're kind of talking to her, and everybody's listening to her. And then the conversation kind of goes to the other end of the table, and he says, I could hear you fucking screaming at me, Mac. I swear to God, I could hear you screaming, say it. And so he said, I looked across the table, and he said, could I talk to you? And she said, sure, right? And then he looked at her and said, you know there's nothing wrong with you, right? You know that what you're going through is absolutely normal for what you've been through, and there's not a fucking thing wrong with you, right? And he said, with that, she burst into tears. And everybody looks at him like, you dick, what'd you say? And she said, then she says, no, I'm happy. I'm happy. And they have this conversation, and then he forwards me this incredible text she sent to him, starting with, how could I ever thank you for what you did for me last night? And now this is a kid who watched his mother die at 11, got hit in the head with a discus at the age of 16, joins the Marine Corps. He's a tough guy, wants to be a recon guy. Gets kicked in the head in a swimming event, aggravates his TBI, and now he's a maintainer. And so he sees this thing I do, and then he begins to use that to help change other people's lives. And when you're doing that as part of helping and serving, which I think we're naturally prone to do, you have these incredible experiences where you help people. And that's got to be a part of it, because if you're not doing that and all you're doing is endurance, it's a loser of a recipe, in my opinion. There's got to be joy in there, and you've got to figure out a way to convert your suffering and trauma into joy, which is not easy to do. But I'm going to tell you, you can do it. And that's why this is so amazing, because, you know, and Alex is a poster child for it, right? When you hear the happiness that he has when he talks about his daughter and his life now, right, and going from his house in the woods being set on fire to now being the person he never thought he would be with, you know, a homeowners association and cul-de-sacs and shit like that. But when you hear the happiness in his voice, right, and that joy, the next question becomes, okay, is there any way that we could replicate that in this area of our lives that isn't so pretty? And the answer to that is absolutely yes. And I see it all the time. And that, if you can do that, right, then that avoiding the negative is only the first part of stabilization. And then propelling them to a greater life is simply a question of, will you say, can I talk to you? Will you say what my gunny said to me, which is, you know, and I tell a story about the first person I ever did this with. And so I had done this. I didn't even think you started coming on yet, but I had done this from 2016 to 2018. Maybe you had just started coming on in 2018, I think. And this Marine listens. His name's Luke Weichel, lives in Huntsville, Alabama. And he, you know, served in Fallujah, Lance Corporal, had friends killed, right? And he's emailing me drunk late at night. And so the emails just get worse and worse and worse. And we've all been a part of this, right, as drinking late at night. And I call him. I'm like, hey, Luke, man, you got to stop drinking. His response, I know. And I said, no, I don't mean it like that. And now I'm out of the Marine Corps for 3 years. He's out of the Marine Corps for 8 years. And I said this, Alex, I'm giving you a fucking order to stop drinking. Do you understand me? Now, if you were playing Family Feud, Alex, what's the number one most likely answer to a guy who got out of the Marine Corps 8 years ago as a corporal?
I mean, honestly, probably fuck off.
Let's just remove the word.
I want to say, in all honesty, though, maybe not. My father, you know.
Wait a minute. Let's just remove the word probably from your answer, okay? Fuck off, right? Fuck you. What do you think he said? He said yes.
I'd imagine that. He said yes, sir. Good man.
But the difference is I was playing the part for him that my gunny played for me. Of somebody
exactly right,
who loved him, who cared about him. I knew my gunny would die for me. And so when he looks at me and says that, right, I initially didn't understand it, right? But it's the most profound wisdom anybody's ever given me in my life. And it changed my life. And so I didn't realize what giving it would do for me. And because I had helped Marines, I tried to as a leader my whole life. It wasn't till 2.5 months later when his mother writes me an email to thank me. And I said, Libby, you don't have to thank me. I've seen him fight. Maybe not him specifically, but I've seen them fight. the most courageous, selfless people I've ever been in my life. I've seen in my life. I'd do anything for your kid. And then she yoked me up. She said, yeah, you don't get it, Mac. I was like, what? Like somebody's mom's yoking my shit up? Like, what the fuck's going on, right? And then she said, look, I used to lay in this bed and, you know, and I knew I was terrified my son was going to kill himself. We all were. And you changed all that. And I couldn't go to sleep that night. And so this thing, this flat black traumatic wisdom, right? And again, if you don't have a serious mental illness and you're capable of reasoning, you can understand this shit and you can change your life. You got to embrace certain things. But, I mean, that's the way life is. And so when you couple those two things, just the basic rules of this is what you got to do to stabilize your life, and this is what you got to do to live a great life, then once they know that, this is my experience, get the fuck out of their way and watch what they do. The two, a PFC and Lance Corporal that called me at 3:13 in the morning, those yo-yos, they just spoke in front of an entire Marine company last week. You should have seen the text message I got later. Dude, I was shaking. I've never even spoken to my squad before, and now I stood up in front of a company, and I knew half those motherfuckers, right? Because it wasn't their company, it was a different company. And I was straight up shaking. The other one says, yeah, like I was ready to black out, man. at one point. And you're standing there, and I'm standing off on the side, and I'm watching them talk about how they – and they're these – and Alex, you've met them. They're miracles from what they came from, drugs in their homes, all kinds of craziness in their homes. One of them ate you know, Fruity Pebbles for like 6 months straight, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And they're United States Marines. You're not supposed to be able to get there. These guys are miracles. And then you watch them do that, and I'm sitting against – so I feel like a dad, right, watching my kids do something. I'm like, fuck yeah, man, look at this shit. And they're helping people. Guys are coming up to them afterwards. Could I talk to you later? Like, yeah, man, come by my room. And you're just seeing the coolest thing, which is us leveraging these things with this flat black traumatic wisdom to help other people. And that is the life-changing event that takes you to the great place. And but you're the poster child for it, man. You're living it.
I would say I'm a poster child today. The same way, you know, I've had a few people in the past few months come to me and say, hey, man, you're doing really well in your career. Agreed, and I appreciate it, but it's all a house of cards. Mental health is a house of cards. Maybe not a house of cards, but just like physical health. You're not going to get a 300 PFT if you just work out really hard today. You know, you've got to work out every day. You got to put some time in a couple of times a week. You have to put forth effort. You got to be willing to put forth effort. And a big part of that is accepting the fact that it's okay to be a little selfish. It's okay to work on you. Working on you genuinely benefits the people around you. Like Mac is saying, once you can get yourself out of the hole, you can reach down and help other people out of the hole, and you'll feel better. Every time you will reframe your negative experiences as tools that you can use to help others. And it really will. I have literally quoted Mac God knows how many times, or handed out Mac's phone number to people, strangers on Facebook. I've even quoted Mac to my wife, who her mother passed away 5 years ago now. And, you know, she had quit her job and was her mother's hospice nurse for the last 2 months of her life. And my wife still struggles with that period of time. But the thing she told me just recently was, I should be over this by now. You know, it was 5 years ago. Why am I still this fucked up? And I literally said, well, you know what Mac would say? He'd say, there's nothing wrong with you. This is just the nature of the beast. We're working on it. We're fixing it. We're working on you. But you're going to end up being able to help me, being able to help our daughter, being able to help your friends because of your journey.
She will struggle with that until she dies.
Forever.
I mean, there's, you know, that stuff is laser blasted into your brain tissue. I mean, I say
it's
this.
It's part of the fabric of who you are.
Well, you know, look, I see a picture of this guy. He's an Iwo Jima veteran in a story last February, 75 years ago. He's in an assisted living facility in Massachusetts. He doesn't know what his last name is most days, right? He sure as fuck doesn't know what zip code his car keys are in. But if you ask him about Iwo Jima, he will tell you in slow motion, high definition what he did. So what does that tell you about the effect on of trauma, how it embeds itself in our brain. And it ain't, it is not going away. And that's the normal state. So, of course, how could she be over? This is the woman who raised her, right? And now you turned into her, you know, her hospice, care provider. You're never going to get over that. So then the question is, okay, is there any way that I could use these things to make my life better? And my answer to that is absolutely you can. Absolutely you can.
I agree. And I guess my parting shot on the
subject. But I want to congratulate you for quoting me to your wife under that.
Let
me just tell you, Alex, it's the absolute truth. I had this kid, his father commits suicide on the phone when he's with him and his mom and his brother when he's 9, right? He has to counsel his mother at 10. Mom, you need to get out of bed and be our mom. We need you to be our mom, right? In sixth grade, one of his best friends hangs himself because being sexually abused at home. He joins the Marine Corps. His uncle murders his aunt in front of him. And then he joins the Marine Corps. His brother commits suicide. He goes home to bury his brother, finds out his brother was sleeping with his fiance for the last year. Didn't know about it. So you hear this bullshit story, and you think it's bullshit. And I remember the first conversation I had with him, he was walking out before the class started. And the audiovisual guy came and said, you should talk to this guy. So we go into this little coffee kiosk at the Staff NCO Academy at Camp Johnson aboard Camp Lejeune. And he sits down before I do, and he looks up at me and he says, does it ever stop hurting? And I said, no, never. And he said, because you were brutally honest with me, he said, that's why I sat down and talked to you, because nobody says shit like that. And when you do, that truth, that credibility, that made me want to have a conversation with you. And I think that in you saying that to her, and it's absolutely true, you know, hopefully we'll be comforting it. It's nothing wrong with you, you know, beautiful, you know, and whenever you feel like this, come sit next to me. We'll go for a walk. But just know that you can't go through that stuff without it sticking to you. And it's going to stick to you forever, and it's okay. But there is a way to transcend this, and this is how we're going to do it. And so honestly, it's crazy. And I mean, the things that we talk about, I just got an email. Mac, this is a crazy, amazing conversation. I've never heard anybody talk about the life of a veteran like you just talked about, that takes it from childhood trauma all the way to increased suicide numbers between 55 and 74, and then in parentheses, which I had no idea about. I would have guessed what Alex was going to guess. This is an incredible conversation. I'm so happy I'm listening to it. I continue to be inspired by all of this, especially discussions like this, and I am committed to using my shit to make other people better. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to both of you. I also thought the discussion on parenting was really cool. Put a smile on my heart. Semper Fi, boys. Keep up the good work.
Hey, Semper Fi, that's a great message.
How about that?
Yeah.
No.
See? No. It's worth digging into your trauma.
Well, you know, no, but again, the thing that I tell people is, that I challenge them with is, look, man, do you not believe, if I footnoted this stuff, all this stuff I'm going to tell you, it would be Lance Corporal here, Sergeant here, Corporal here, PFC here, from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, that I've all come on my program and talked about this shit over the last 4.5 years. It's all fucking Marine shit. It's all fucking legit. Show me something that you see in here that's bullshit. And you know there's nothing. And so embrace, you know, what the truth that's come out of our incredible culture, and then go change people's lives and watch what happens to you and the shit that you're going to replace the dominant emotion in your life. It's not going to be trauma and sadness anymore. It's going to be joy. And you went through that shit, and it'll always be with you, but you're going to replace the dominant emotion in your life when you begin to give to others and help others, and you're doing the best you can do. That's all you can do. And then they do it, man. And it's amazing. And let me tell you, at some point, wait till your wife looks at somebody else and says, quotes you to them. Alex got this from a friend, but, you know, I was struggling, and something that helped me was this. There's nothing wrong with me, that I'm going to struggle with this forever. And you know what? I mean, after he said it, because look, you know, Alex, he's not the brightest bulb in the chandelier. He's a great guy and I love him to death, but come on, right? But what he said was absolutely true. And it's always provided comfort to me and I love it. And that's what, I mean, and it's just, that's the stuff I hear all the time. And like I said, I mean, I tell everybody, maybe, I mean, you could be as cool as me. Just don't be afraid to share that stuff. Don't be afraid to give.
50% is cool.
No, you might be able to be cooler, but I tell people, I said, look, this shit now happens to me almost every day. I'm sitting here yesterday. Sunday after email. Hey, Mac, thank you very much for so I did the presentation. I narrated it and I have it in 5 segments. Have I sent you the links?
I don't think you have. No. No, you haven't.
I'd love I'll send it to you and you and your wife should watch it. It'll provide great
comfort.
And anybody who's listening out there, if you want to see it, I have to put you on this list. It gives you access to the files, blah, blah, blah. Send me an email. And I will guarantee that you this. If you will do the stuff that Marines have taught me to do, because I never thought I'd be doing this. I was just struggling with my own shit, you know, it starts with my family, you know, blowing up when I was about 19 and my parents never speaking again the rest of their lives. Then the helicopter crash, everybody dies. You're trying to save them, everybody's dying. You know, 3 combat deployments, the murder of my 2 nephews, one of my 2 younger sisters freezing to death. I was trying to help myself. I would never looking to do anything like this, but I kept getting my head shoved under the water like a lot of people do of this shit. Life was just not very cool to me. And so what do you do with it? I was just trying to survive, but they've taught me so much shit about this, right? It's been a horizontal theme of this program since I started, post-combat related mental health. Then I had this epiphany. This isn't about post-combat related mental health.
It's about trauma, you know?
And everybody's got that going in their life. And I do this drill in an auditorium and I say, put your hand up and leave it up when I call these things out. If you've dealt with it in your life, maybe not you personally, but somebody close to you. Okay. You know, somebody who's committed suicide, all these hands go up. You know, somebody who's been raped, you know, somebody who's been hazed or bullied. You've watched a family member that you love, you know, slowly die of a terminal illness. Somebody who in your life's been killed by, in a car accident. And I go down this list and I said, okay, now everybody look around. The only people that don't have both hands up are people that simply don't want to put their hands up.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they don't know that, right? And we're all faking it. And I look around and I said, so look, man, stop faking it, right? We're all dealing with this shit. And there is no – and then I have this little thing I do about the best form of trauma is combat trauma, because you claim it on your DD-214, right, the diagnosis of PTSD. You know, you'll get paid, you know, $1,300 to $3,000 a month depending on severity. You know, you'll have – therapist from the VA calling you every once in a while, asking you if you're okay and whatnot. And then anytime you go to see the Carolina, you know, Panthers play football, you know, everybody's going to stand up at some point and say, how about a big round of applause for our active duty service members, our first responders, and our veterans. We get our asses kicked. Elizabeth Smart, who was raped every day for 9.5 months, she doesn't get any of that, right? She gets none of that. So we're actually exalted in our trauma. Not too many people are. First responders are. So we're in a special class. It's the best deal going. If you were raped as a little kid, do you talk about it? Fuck no, you don't.
You spend the rest of your life running from talking about it.
Right.
You know?
Listen to this. A friend of mine who listens sent me this email. We were roommates twice as infantry officers. I need to talk to you. Okay. So he tells me this story that he's been raped in his life 3 different times. 3 different times. And he essentially got kicked out of the Marine Corps for conduct unbecoming an officer. Prior enlisted, one of the, you know, 2 of the sexual assaults happened while he was a junior enlisted guy at Pendleton. And he said, I've been a drunk and unfaithful piece of shit. And I finally, after listening to you, decided to tell people in my family. And I said, let me guess what happened. I said, their reaction was exactly the opposite of what you've been running from. And he said, you're right. There's tears and people hugged me. And why didn't you tell us sooner? I said, we're afraid, man. We self-imprison. Imagine that, man.
100% true.
Imagine that. And those are the guys we serve with, right? So where's this desire to be tough come from? It comes from a lot of different places. So anyway, wow. That was a decent therapy session. What are you writing about?
We've got a bunch of really cool stuff coming out. I am personally working on a story, total diversion from our discussion, but I'm excited about it. Apparently in the 90s, there was a plan for a while to make a version of the F-22 Raptor with swing wings, like the F-14, that was going to be brought in for naval service. I love stories like this, so I've been slowly – I'm incapable of actually taking 4 days off, so I've been researching this while trying to fool my wife into thinking I'm playing games on my phone. I'm excited about this story coming out, but we've got some other great stuff. One story that just went up is by a former member of the Special Forces cadre for selection and assessment, writing about the gray man. This kind of speaks to that tough guy idea that we have. The gray man is sort of a legend in the special operations community, where you are like a secret squirrel. You can blend in any environment. And his article, I think, very, very accurately kind of dismisses the idea that you need to be the gray man. And instead, you need to embrace who you are, whether you're in special operations or the conventional forces. Just like we're talking about with trauma, be honest with yourself about who you are so that you can identify your strengths and lean into those strengths. Don't try to be somebody else. I love content like that. So we've got a couple stories from Steve Ballastieri, George Hand, a former Delta Force operator.
Why do I know Ballastieri's name?
He's also a really big New England Patriots journalist, other than being former Special Forces warrant officer. Since then, he's become a sports journalist, pretty big in the New England area. Got so it. If you follow the Patriots, you might have heard his name.
Got it.
George Hand, Delta Force guy, and Justin Lee, an F-35 pilot. We've got great stuff coming from all four of them this week.
What do you think of the stories that are coming out today that the Israelis allegedly assassinated that that Iranian nuclear scientist,
the flying machine gun.
Yeah, to me, I anything that comes out of Iran, it's like, okay, I got it. Do you place any credence in any of that?
Iran uses the same reflexive control approach to information that the Soviet Union used to, and currently Russia does, which is this idea that if you kind of inundate the media sphere with a story, you get to frame it any way that you want. I think it's entirely possible, but I think it's fairly unlikely that it was a drone machine gun. The Soviet Union, Russia experimented with building an AK-based drone machine gun. The problem with those things is that they're not all that effective in an actual combat environment, because it's very difficult to make a correction for the recoil, especially in an automatic firearm on a quad rotor. If instead it's prop driven, then it's incredibly difficult to get actually on target. I think it's fairly unlikely that it was a drone machine gun, but I'm not going to say impossible, especially Israel's got the money to develop some pretty incredible things. Whether or not it was the Mossad, though, I'd 100% buy that it was Mossad that actually killed him. Whether or not they were using an AK drone or just a guy, I would lean towards just a guy personally.
Right. No, it's been amazing. I saw a pretty interesting article and analysis of this. Like, all summer long, there's been explosions in Iran, all over the country, either at facilities that support nuclear weapons or whatnot. And they said, look, this is beyond the Mossad. This is something also that maybe a partnership between the Mossad and internal Iranian groups that are pretty formidable. And that's
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. Right. Iran's military presence, their Quds force, is built around that concept in other nations.
Right.
So it would be – so the Quds Force, for anyone who's not familiar, is effectively like Iran's special forces mixed with CIA in a way. What they really do is they go elsewhere in the world and they help establish terrorist militias effectively. The same way our special forces units go around to other nations and train our partner nation militaries right. to defend themselves. Right. Iran sends their equivalent out to go and teach people how to form terror cells to kind of advance their own foreign policy, but you know, as an extension of Iran's foreign policy. So the idea that within Iran that same process could be leveraged makes perfect sense to me. Right. You know, it's a formal part of their military apparatus, which means it's in terms of doctrinal thought, it's already there. So I think it's entirely feasible that there are elements within Iran that are supporting this sort of thing, especially because all of the Middle East is such a quagmire of you know, if you look at what's going on in Syria, there are really conflicts between – there are three different proxy conflicts going on in Syria right now, not counting the civil war that we really tend to focus on, you know. So because of that, I find it entirely feasible that that there's an element within Iran that's supporting maybe foreign intelligence operations, especially to position themselves to be in a position of leadership, to be maybe the usurping leader in a future conflict in Iran. I think it's 100% possible. I think that it's entirely possible that these people were trained by Iran's own military. You know, so
one more question, I'll let you go because you've been exceedingly gracious with your time, which you should have been given that we haven't talked in a bit. But so I find it entirely appropriate.
Yeah, fair.
Here's an email that says, "Hey, Mac, I'm curious. When news breaks like this, where does Alex go? In the first hour, you were talking about going to Israeli national newspapers looking for analysis to what they had to say, which tends to be a little bit different than what we would get for consumption here in the United States. I like that. Is there something that Alex would recommend to us when we go looking for information as a news guy? So when you go looking for information about things like this, where do you go?"
Well, to be honest with you, it's kind of a pile of different things. And I use the word pile intentionally because
– yeah, that's normally not a complimentary term, pile.
Exactly. You know, so when you go to the pile, you're going to find a lot of information, right? I'm going to pull it from Twitter. I'm going to pull it from news outlets that maybe I respect and some that I don't. And then I'm also going to talk to anyone that I know. This is the real – business of being a journalist is developing your network, right? Which is just people that you can ask, usually off the record. We usually say, "Hey, I'd like to ask you a few questions on background." And what that really means is I'm hoping you can give me some context for me to speak to without actually putting your name in anything. And so the first things that I do, in all honesty, are, you know, open source news outlets. If the story's already been reported, you know, if it's something breaking, you'll usually get one or two sentences out of Reuters or the AP that kind of gives you a sense of what you should be searching for, right? Then my next step after that is I start shooting out emails to people I know that are either involved with whatever the news story is. It might be, for instance, Jack Murphy has spent a long time in the Philippines working with the Philippine Special Operations Units. You know, he's a former Green
Beret. Okay, so hold on. I think so. This is like open source stuff. So when you see something break news, what's the first place you go to that's open source?
The first place that I go to that's open source, this is going to sound terrible, but it's just whoever I spot first in my newsfeed or whoever. I have an understanding that every message has a motive. I think we all need to maintain that understanding. So when you see a story pop up, for me, it's not always necessarily that I'll see a story pop up. I might get an email or a text or a Slack message or any one of the other 900 ways to get a hold of me saying something big just happened. Especially, I've got some buddies who work security contracting who are either former American or British military that I've worked with in the past that'll send me a heads up. But I'm willing to look at any open source news outlet. I'm willing, you know, whether it's CNN or Fox or the Daily Wire, or I'm willing to look.
So you don't necessarily immediately run to Twitter and start and pump in a hashtag and start looking for stuff. You don't have
I do as a part of my first pass. That first pass is going to be open source media information. I'm going to use keywords that I've identified through that open source information to look for things on social media that may pertain specifically to it.
Got it.
And those are two things that I do while I'm waiting for people that I know to get back to me.
Got it.
You know, so okay. if I know somebody that was – if it's a special operations related story, I'll reach out to a buddy I may have that worked in that force, even if they may not have information about what's going on right now. A Navy SEAL just got arrested for what have you. I'm going to reach out to my Navy SEAL buddies to get some context on how this would happen within the Navy SEAL unit, right? Yeah. So I guess my short answer is that there's no set process. I'm going to look at everything in the pile and start just trying to sift the garbage out. Then I'm going to start trying to get secondary sources to support information that I think is probably accurate.
Got it.
So it's a complicated mess, but the best way to answer it for a person out there who's not a journalist, who doesn't have a network of people that they're going to reach out to, I very rarely will tell you that there's a specific outlet that you should refer to for good information. The reason is that large outlets especially have a ton of stakeholders. They have a ton of influences that can skew a story, and the writer himself has his own pile of influences and stakeholders and concerns. You can find good journalism on any outlet, and you can find bad journalism on any outlet. So what I recommend to readers who want to have a good understanding of what's going on around the world is identify writers, identify journalists or editors that you feel as though consistently give you a fair shake of what's going on, and then seek out their work. It isn't easy to do. The internet isn't set up to allow you to do that. But you know, Jack Murphy's a guy I talk about a lot because in a way he was a mentor of mine.
Right.
But there are a million dudes out there. Luke Ryan is a –
with
a great
reverence,
example.
I might add. He talks about Murphy. Absolutely. With reverence.
You know, Marty Scovlin Jr., who runs Coffee or Die, is another great example of a guy that will give you a fair shake. Identify those writers and look for them instead of the outlets that they write on. They may write for five different sites, but you'll know that you can find some pretty good content from that person. It's my best advice for anybody out there trying to avoid bias.
One more email. Mac, ask Alex this. Has he seen The Social Dilemma?
I have. I have watched The Social Dilemma. To be honest, a lot of it was stuff that I was familiar with already, although they do make a very convincing argument. You know, I still stand by my belief. I think that they would probably support that social media is the worst thing that's ever happened to the world.
I just saw somebody – who did I – I saw Lady Gaga say that. We all can agree that social media is the single worst thing that's ever happened to humankind.
I try to live by the idea that there are two types of people in this world, and I would rather not talk to either of them.
I'll tell you what, I went through something over Thanksgiving. My kids were ready to kill me, but I have a gift in that I can listen to the same song for hours, right? And I'm lost, and something in the song appeals to me. So I saw the song song called Hollow, right, that she and Bradley Cooper sang. And I don't know.
My wife loves that song.
Oh, my God. Well, listen. So I hear it, and it appeals to my ear. Blah, 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 blah.
That's a good song, yeah.
Right. So then I watch the video of them doing it at the Academy Awards. I'm like, holy shit, man. Like, what's that all about? And so then I see an interview, and she says, he directed the film. And I didn't know that. I'm like, holy shit, man. I just thought he was like some like good-looking actor dude, right? And so then she says, oh, and that thing you saw at the Academy Awards? That's all him. He directed the whole thing. We worked on it for a week. And then Jimmy Kimmel says, are you in love with Bradley Cooper? And she looks at him and says, it's called acting. She said, we fooled you, right? Because everybody thinks that.
Honestly, I even said that to my wife. I was like, that dude's in trouble with his wife when he gets home.
Right?
Watching the Academy
Awards.
And
she says, he choreographed every bit of that. She said, I'm a stage artist. I don't give up anything I do on stage, but I did to him because of the detail. So then I see an interview with both of them together, this dude from People Magazine. And he's a quiet, composed, you know, dude. And so is she. She's Lady Gaga is a fictitious character that she plays, right? Her first name is Stephanie. He calls her Stephanie. And he said, so I go over to Stephanie's house, and she says, well, we're both Italian. I start making pasta, and then he says, will you sing a song with me? And she says, I didn't even know he could sing. And then we sit down to sing this song on my piano, and I just stopped and said, Bradley, you've got a voice. And then the guy says, so what is A Star Is Born about? And he says, well, it's about whatever you think it's about. I mean, you're the audience. And he says, well, what are the things you deal with? The first word out of his mouth, trauma. And then I'm like, whoa! So now I'm listening to the song differently.
Now I might have to actually watch the movie.
Well, and right, as a little kid, his dad's a drunk, right? He becomes his dad's drinking partner. He tries to I hadn't watched the whole movie. I'd watched about half, and then I think I fell asleep. He tries to kill himself, and he tries to hang himself when he's 13 off the ceiling fan. The ceiling fan pulls out of the ceiling and cuts his forehead, and his dad never notices. And he emits all this in the movie, right? And I'm thinking, fuck, if I could have got to that dude, I could have helped him, right? He has this incredible form to change people's lives, but he doesn't know that – he doesn't understand flat black traumatic wisdom. He doesn't understand the fourth path. And now I listen to the song completely different. And my daughter's like, Dad, you have to stop. I'm like, I can't. I brought speakers into the kitchen because I was in the kitchen most of Thanksgiving, right? I brought these vintage 1995 Bose 401 speakers into the kitchen, set them up, and I blasted that shit all fucking day because it's speaking to me. Yeah, trauma. Check it out. All right, man. First of all, it's good to hear your voice again. I enjoyed talking to you, and happy birthday to your daughter. Happy Thanksgiving to you and your wife. And I will shoot you 5 links. If you will text me or somehow other message me an email address, I'll send you. You'll get 5 links, and you guys can watch it. I think
you've got it. I'll send you the address right now. Thanks, man. I'm looking forward to going through it with my wife. I think she'll like it.
Oh no! Trust me. It is not a military thing. It is for anybody who's had their life door kicked by trauma, and you know how you can use that to live a great life, not a good life, a great life. And it will speak to both of you. I know that. So anyway, man, have a great week. I'll talk to you in a couple.
You got it. Thank you so much.
No, thank you, man. Alex Hollings, man. The one and only Alex Hollings here he's like so happy to be done with that. But no, here's another email. Wow. If it was warmer, I'd be sweating right now. That was pretty cool. Always enjoy these discussions, Mac. Sometimes they're hairpin turns in them. But you tend to have smart people on, and I always enjoy the conversation. Yeah, you know, it's what I've been doing since I started. You know, hard subjects, smart people, and don't be afraid to ask smart people, you know, hard questions and get them to footnote their answers and things like that. And so, and he's one of them. And the other thing that's kind of unique about Alex is his willingness to talk about his willingness to talk about his life. Yeah. A lot of people won't. He will. So, yeah, interesting. Interesting stuff. I had the same reaction. My son Patrick said, hey, did you see that supposedly that machine gun was remote controlled? My response was, I'm not exactly sure about that. But we shall see, man. We shall see. So I hope everybody out there had a great Thanksgiving. I hope everybody's healthy. Just got an email from a friend that said for the second time he's tested negative for COVID after he tested positive. So I think that's how many you need, right? Don't you have to test positive, test negative twice? So so good for him. Anyway, see if we can get Grant Newsham to come on tomorrow. So we'll see if we can do that. And the question is, what direction does the United States take relative to Iran, relative to China? How's all that going to work out? So we shall see. And hopefully what the United States does is, in the collective, I mean, think about this. You have the Arab world that's thrown in that will recognize Israel in its effort to further isolate Iran. How about that? Never thought you'd see that day, did you? Where you have Saudi Arabia talking about, you know, I saw an article that said the only reason Saudi Arabia did not recognize Iran, I mean Israel, is that they're unsure of the direction of the Biden administration. If a Biden administration that includes John Kerry will go back to the policies of the Obama administration. And you're like, oh man, we're on the cusp of, you know, something good. So anyway, thanks for listening. See if we can get Grant on tomorrow. Otherwise, don't touch that dial. This program continues. Yeah, there was a bit of a technical glitch at the start of the program, as happens with technology and software. They did not sync up the way they should, and somebody did an update which throws a switch and something's not working. And so it took about a half hour to fix. So I appreciate those people that were listening for hanging in there with me. More than anything else, I want to encourage you. Like I said before, if you'd like to see post-traumatic winning, shoot me an email. mac.allmarineradio@gmail.com. That comes to my corporate headquarters, which is my cell phone. Yep. And then go ahead and see what happens. Yeah, just tell me. Hey, I'd love to see it. And I can't let you download it, but you can stream it. And then I promise you, when you see the path that it lays out, you will find it to be life-changing. So, yeah, I've done this now for 2 years of my life, and I've seen it over and over and over and over. And there's no doubt in my mind anymore. I'll read you one more email. Hey, Mac, I just wanted to echo what somebody emailed you a little bit ago. I've never heard anybody walk trauma from childhood to the age of 55 to 74, I have to tell you how impressed I was with that. And I believe you are onto something. Congratulations on the work you're doing. But that kind of blew me away this morning. That for many of us, these things start when we're young. It piles up. We don't find a way to make it good. And the endurance thing just gets absolutely old and shitty. I think that's spot on. It makes total sense to me. Keep up the great work. I'm waiting for the book, by the way. Yeah, no kidding, man. No kidding. So, yeah, don't touch that dial. This program continues right now with the first part of this, hour one. So have a great Monday, and we will see you tomorrow on a Monday. All Marine Radio, out.